history of its creation deny absolutely any basis which can be described as with the concept of a last additive. Every event and every question which is concerned with the creation of the Talmud and related to it in any way is not the result of an activity that was done at once or in a particular generation or by a particular scholar or by a particular committee, but is a consequence of a long process that went on for many, many generations, a process in which many different Rabbanim participated from various different generations. Therefore, it is possible to say with absolute certainty that the Talmud as a literary creation doesn't leave any place to say that there was a last editor who was of the Talmud, because the entire existence of the Talmud as we see it in front of us shows evolution and development and not a last edition. And therefore, he says, if there was no last edition, the idea that Rav Ashi was the editor of the Talmud it makes no sense, because the history of the Talmud doesn't admit of any last editor. The origin of the idea that Rav Ashi was the editor of the Talmud is the statement in Rav Matzia, Rav Ashi Rabina Sofaro. And Amar Rabina Mahadura Kama the Rav Ashi Amalekne Mahadura Bata Rav Ashi Amal Yachlof. On the basis of these two sources is the whole idea, well-known idea, that Rav Ashi organized the Talmud in two editions. This notion takes the expression Sofaro to mean the end of the period of the Noraim, and therefore Rav Ashi and Rabina are the end of the Noraim, therefore the editors of the Shas, and the phrase Mahadura to mean addition. That is, Rav Ashi worked over in his yeshiva the Gemara twice, and therefore that Rav Ashi organized the Talmud in two editions in the current meaning of the word Mahadura. But in reference to these two sources themselves, it's many can explain these two expressions and with a simple meaning. With the phrase Sofaro, we can explain the teaching of Halacha. And with the phrase Mahadura, already Rabbi Geshe-Mernagar says that it refers to when they were studying from him in his youth, that is, when they were sitting around Rav Ashi in the first of his 30-year cycle, and the Mahadura Batra in his old age when he repeated his Talmud. Therefore, there is no meaning that we can attach to this, not to the additions in our meaning or to the organization of the Talmud. And so on. Let's go on with this. Okay. And now let's turn to the letter of Rav Shiva Gaon, because it, as is well known, one refers to this idea of Rav Ashi's editor of the Gemara and Rav Shiva Gaon's letter in one breath. That is, as if Rav Shiva Gaon's letter expresses this. But when before we turn to Rav Shiva Gaon's letter, it's not unnecessary to say a few short words about the character of the letter itself. When we look carefully into this letter and organize it as a whole, we see that there are two different parts, different from one another in their structure and in their content. And so on, he analyzes and says that the first part gives a chronology of the development of the Talmud, and then he reverts back to a chronology of the development of the exilarchy. Now, let's in paragraph 2 of this. Now let's turn to the R issue, and that is the question of the organization of the Talmud and Rav Ashi's as its editor. First of all, we should emphasize that although in many, many places Rav Shiva Gaon in his letter clearly talks about the organization of the Mishnah by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, there's not a single time where he explicitly says anything about the organization of the Talmud or of Rav Ashi as its organizer. This is all that comes into contact with this. After he says in two places, Derech Klal, Itosif Talmuda, Dor Avarta Dor, he says in a third place, Ulefum Hochi Yotosif Hara Dor Avarta Ra Ad Rabina De Ipsak Kidechaza Shmuel, until Shmuel Yochinah, the Sifrod Adam HaRishon, Rav Ashi Rabina Sof Hara. Ubatar Hochi Badai Apple Gifta Hara Lo Havit, Ika Pirushi Usfaroi, Krovim Lahora, Viku Hanu Rabuta Rabbanan Sfaroi. There is, even though there was no actual Hora, there were explanations, as Dr. Schwaber said, close to being Hora, but, and they were called Rabbanan Sfaroi. This is everything that's found in the first half, which contains his investigations on the Torah Sheba Alpeh. And now in the second half, in his presentation of a list of the Chachmei HaDorot and the heads of the yeshivot, according to chronological order, he certainly reaches Rav Ashi. He spends a lot of time discussing Rav Ashi and brings there various different matters which are found in the Talmud. And when he ends his discussion of Rav Ashi, he says this: Rav Ashi was the head of the yeshiva close to 60 years, and that's what it means in Perek Nishamet, Mahadur Kalmud Rav Ashi, he said this, and Mahadur Batud Rav Ashi, he said that. And because the rabbis inaugurated the idea of studying each year two mesechtot, whether it was a full or a defective year. And he died in Tavshin Lamed Tet, and he continues that way without stop. The continuation of the list of the heads of the yeshivot, Umalach Patreba Matamachsi, Rav Yemer, etc., 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 and he goes on and lists all of these different people who came after Rav Ashi. And Vishnat Taftuf Yud Aleph Shachiv Rabina Breda Ravuna, to who Sof Hara? That already, how many years later is that then? It's from Tafshin Lamed Chet to Taftuf Yud Aleph. He says, some 80 years later, that was the end of Hara. And again, he lists Rav Asi as the time in which the Hara came to an end, and the Talmud, Therefore, in the first part, where here, there he lives a general picture of the history of Torah Sheba'al Peh, and where he mentions many, many times in clear language on the organization of the Mishnah, he talks about the Talmud only as a Talmuda or Hara that was developed one generation after another from Amoraim until Ravina. Okay? In the second passage, when he describes the various rabbis and Rashi Yeshivot, the Sfayim Talmud. Right. That's what we read.
Well, the Hara
in that's what, if we interpret Hara to mean that Jewish autonomy came to an end, then first of all there was a loss of Jewish autonomy, and therefore as a consequence the evolution of the Talmud did not proceed in its as active a way as previously, even though it did continue to develop, as Dr. Schwaber says, as in a more scholarly but less official position.
No, he does use the phrase Sofara twice, right?
Right, they're both contemporaries, right. But there are many, both several generations after Rabina and Rav Ashi. Okay. I want to spend some time. Okay, I'll leave it to you to read the rest. I think you do some of this twice, unfortunately. Let me now turn to Dr. Afrati's discussion, which is in this book, Tkufat HaSfaraim V'Safi. Plus, you have to turn several pages because I was sloppy about the Xerox in here, so several pages were Xeroxed twice. Biur Mashmayot. We all have this?
Page Nun.
Page Nun on... Okay? Let's just read. Reshit Aleinu Livdok Mechadash. Does everyone have this? We have it? Yeah, okay. First of all, we have to investigate it once again, the phrases that are used in here, which were... Okay, I'll wait. Does everyone have this now? All right, so first of all, we have to investigate once again the meaning of the phrases that were mentioned, which have been explained for many, many generations, apparently incorrectly. The two earliest sources that we have in which the Rabbanan Svararya mentioned and their activities and their times, which are the Igeret Rav Shua Gaon and Seder Tanaim Varim, refer to the end of the period of the Moroyim as Sofara. And the scholars that were active after the time of the Moroyim as the Rabbanan Svarai, as the Sabarai rabbis. These sources didn't bother to tell us explicitly what the phrase Hora or Sofara means. This is Walter's question. And why do the... are the rabbis who came after the so-called period of Hora, why are they called Rabbanan Svarai? Since Sofara which is also the end of the Talmudic period, many people began to explain the phrase Sofara to mean the completion of the Babylonian Talmud. And they found a great help in the words of Rav Shlira Gaon, because he explicitly talks about Hora that developed one generation after another until the end of Hora and the completion of the Talmud. And this is his time. Right. And therefore, he says, "Umhachi." This is the phrase that we read before. "Itosif hora dora bata dora." The hora was added to one generation after another. "Intinu avina and ravashi sofara." And later on, he writes, "Uvatre malach rav asi uviyomai sofara v'istam talmuda." Therefore, you see the various different people who explain this letter, that Sof Hora and Chatimat HaTalmud, the end of Hora and the completion of the Talmud, are identical. And Dr. Levin, who was the editor of the letter, adds in his note on page 29, as the Drasha of Chazal, Asher Katavte Lo Rotam Zu Talmud, Masbir Ravina Varavashi, is the end of the Hora, because they completed the Talmud, which is Hora. On this explanation, which by the way is also accepted by various different investigators, he reverts many times, and he uses this as the prime source in his book, the Sevarot Rabbis and their Talmud, and therefore he explains that the end of the conclusions of the Sugyot and the end of the discussion of the Moroim and the Gemara. And this is the meaning of the phrase Hora. But now, Efrati says, this whole theory on the issue of the completion of the Talmud by Rav Ashi and Rabina has been overturned in our generation by Rabbi Abraham Weiss, which we just read. And Rav Shvira, in any event, doesn't mention in any place either the phrase the completion of the Talmud, or as Rav Rashi as the completer or the editor of the Talmud. And the Talmud itself was not in fact completed in the time of Rav Ashi and Ravina, which were the sixth generation of the Moroim, because after them we find at least two additional generations of a Moroim in the Gemara itself, which come after Ravina and Rav Ashi. And in the letter of Rav Shlira Gaon, we find, as is well known, an entirely different theory, according as to the creation of the Talmud and its organization, which seems much more natural. And this is what Rav Shlira Gaon writes: "Behilein milin itosif Talmuda dora bata dora, b'chol dora kavin be milin svekid machadshin ubayi etc." In this way, the Talmud was added to one generation after the other. Every generation incorporated various different discussions of problems that arose and questions and so on. In other words, the Talmud developed during the entire Amoraic period, one layer after another, and every generation incorporated in the Talmud the various its own innovations. And someone who follows carefully the traces of the sugyot and the shas, in fact finds the words of the Amoraim as they're organized, in fact, in exactly this way, one generation after the other. Okay. It's difficult to agree in what Weiss's phrase, sofo ra, because, which he interprets as the end of the Tkufat Amoraim, and now let's skip down to the next paragraph and see how Frath explains. The correct explanation of the phrase hora is command. And the meaning of the phrase to command means to command. The noun and the verb are found mainly on the issues of halacha. Hora, papa, and so on. Hora, ploni, and so on. To teach, to give a ruling on the issues of isur v'heter, or in the issue of legal disputes, only a person who is authorized to do so from some institution, who has an authorization, can issue such a command under the condition that he received an appointment from the appropriate authority. And if the judge acts on the basis of the appropriate authority, even if he doesn't decide according to the Din Torah, but according to the various laws of the state, nevertheless, his decision is the decision. And already it was a question at the issue of Mumche l'Rabim Hadan Yechidi, if a person who is authorized to judge alone, does this mean Gavir v'Savir, that is someone who is sufficiently well-educated, or even though he did not receive an appointment from the exilarch to adjudicate civil cases, or perhaps the phrase Mumche l'Rabim means someone who actually also received an appointment from the authority. The scholars of Kirwan ask the Savarak rabbis, how were they organized after Rabina, and who ruled over them from the heads of the yeshivot, and how many years did they rule from that time until now? They ask then only on the issue of the time after Rabina. But the Rav Shira Gaon, in his answer, when he gets to this point, starts his history from the very beginning. As you asked about the Rabbanan Savari, how did they organize after Rabina and who ruled over them, I see fit to explain to you the issues of this matter, and then he starts with the original Galut of Yohanan all the way back 1,000 years earlier.
So this is the chain of authority,
right?
The apostolic.
The reason this is very simple. The Babylonian Gaon is explaining in his letter not only the evolution, the history, the chain of Kabbalah of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, one generation after another, but is also explaining the sources of authority of the various generations to rule. This source derives from the authority of the exilarch. And in fact, the exilarch had existed, according to Rav Shura's Gaon opinion, all the days of the Second Temple. We may or may not agree with Rav Shira Gaon's opinion, but that was his opinion on this matter.
So Papa was even superior to Eretz Yisrael.
Well, that the Gemara says, that Shevet, lo yosef Shevet mi Yehudah, meaning that they had higher authority. But according to Rav Shira Gaon, according to modern scholarship, the exilarch was someone who was created around the time of the destruction of the temple. But according to Rav Shira Gaon, at least, his theory was that the exilarch as an institution, the exilarchy as an institution, had existed all the way time from the first Galut. And in according to this authority, the right to rule was emanated one generation after another. But when he talks about the creation of the Talmud, Rav Shira Gaon uses a different phrase and says, "Itosif Talmuda dar batogah," that the scholarship increased one generation after another. At the end of the Amoraic period, there were various...
Does that mean the more recent scholars would have been told?
No, they added to the previous one. They added material to the previous ones. Doesn't mean that they were better, and as Newton says, we stand on the shoulders of giants and so on. They were adding material one generation after another. At the end of the Amoraic period, various serious disasters took place, troubles began in Babel, and as a consequence of this, the exilarch rebelled against the central authority. After that, this rebellion was suppressed, the office of the exilarch was destroyed, was eliminated. And therefore, two very difficult things occurred. The Talmud came to an end, that is, the natural growth came to an end, and together with this, there was the end sofara. In other words, temporarily, the interior or Jewish autonomy from Jewish judges were taken away. They could no longer adjudicate cases. Since the authorities eliminated the office of the exilarch, as a matter of consequence, the authority of Jewish judges, which were appointed by the exilarch, also came to an end. From then on, the scholars were called Rabbanan Sfaroi, that is, rabbis who were authorized to teach in the sense that they had the proper education, they knew the tradition, that is the halachot, and knew how to explain them and answer various different problems that arose, but they did not receive an appointment from the exilarch. And therefore they did not have the authority to execute their decisions and enforce their decisions, and this is the meaning of the phrase sofara. The authority of the exilarch was therefore officially eliminated and apparently returned into its existence only after the Arab conquest. And then, of course, an entirely new period starts, and that is the period of the Gaoni. Rav Shira Gaon, therefore, simply describes the beginning of the Sfaroic period and not its end, because he wasn't asked about, he was only asked about its beginning by the scholars of Kirwan. And the Rabbanan Sfaroi, how did they organize, etc., after Rabbeinu. Okay, let's skip a little to the next part.
Who was after them?
Right.
Today.
Right.
They did ask that.
Yes. In other words, Chachmei Koran asked about the organizing from the Sofara onward, and the Gaon explains, according to them, is all the lists of the rabbis until his day, without telling you exactly when the end of the Sofaraic period is. He's just listing the rabbinical authority.
So Sofara means it in the...
No, no. Sofara, according to Ephrakti, and I think that this is the true explanation. And the Sofara simply means that there was this rebellion against the Persian authorities. There was great suppression of the Jewish people, entirely. There were pogroms, but the main political act was the elimination of the office of the exilarch. The office of the exilarch was eliminated, and with it, internal Jewish legal autonomy. There was a period of about 100 years from the end of the 5th, the beginning of the 6th century, until the Arab conquest in the middle of the 7th century, when there was no internal Jewish autonomy, and that's the meaning of the phrase sofara. They hadn't the authority. They could give a decision, perhaps, but they didn't have the authority to enforce it.
They just didn't write it down.
Not that they didn't write it down. If there was a court case, they didn't have the authority to enforce their decisions.
Which meant presumably that people handled their legal matters.
And therefore people handled their legal matters before the Persian courts or what have you, because the Jewish courts were no longer effective in giving rendering decisions.
The Amoraic itself was officially abolished.
It means both. It ceased to exist for a while and then was resurrected after the Arab invasion. And to what extent the resurrection after the Arab invasion represents a direct line continuation of what went on before was a matter of some dispute. In fact, one of the most serious disputes was due to the fact that the Exilok married the daughter or freed bondswoman of one of the captured Persian kings and so on, and there was a whole big to-do about whether she was properly converted or not. Many different issues arose with the story of Ustinoy and so on.
Sorry, I bothered, but the Feinstein, as you said, you don't say he was a Balhorok,
Sure.
It didn't need any authority, it was just an accepted person. There wasn't a great government involved.
Right. That's how we use the word today.
Yes.
Moharoh today means a rabbi who...
Right.
But what he is explaining is that in the technical term, the way the Rav Shiragon uses it, it meant simply that there was a loss of Jewish autonomy. I mean, the same word doesn't necessarily mean the same... The same word doesn't necessarily mean the same thing over a period of 1,000 years.
How long did that second exilarchy last?
Until the 13th century.
One more thing, since we're driving, you said that the Ravina Ravashi proposed the open fund. So all these years before these people were so the Kaddish Kedushim so great, they all were thinking in the wrong way.
Yeah, that's the point.
They always
didn't say they were stupid.
Well, they didn't know anything all these years. Suddenly they came up with a finish that it isn't Sulfurah, it isn't the end of the Talmud, wasn't it redacted at that time, and that's the end.
Right. And the reason...
Mistaken,
okay, so the issue is why... The issue is...
Weiss is better than all these other guys that have lived in all these years.
He made over his...
It's easier to follow what the people
are saying. It's the Yeshiva University. It's not the Yeshiva. It's Yeshiva University. It's the Yeshiva University of 60 years ago. It's not the Yeshiva University of today. Professor Weiss wouldn't be allowed to say these things in the Yeshiva University of today. But in the Yeshiva University of 60 years ago, under Dr. Revel, it was permissible, or even Dr. Belkin, it was permissible to have these ideas.
It's hard to accept that these are suddenly coming out of the
Right. They didn't have jet airplanes then either. That
right.
Doesn't mean they were stupid. They just their knowledge of history wasn't the same.
Jet airplanes didn't make
smart.
No, they don't.
Right.
No, just like we're not smarter than they are if we have airplanes.
Like localists, which they were supposed to find them, it was all of the learned people.
The answer to your question is not so simple. The simple answer, of course, is that we're in possession now, as Jonathan says, of historical facts, just the history of the Persian Empire, and historical facts from various different sources that were not available before. The answer to your question, which is a very good question, is more complicated because there was a transition from the Gaonic period into the period of the Rishonim. Both the Rambam on the one hand, and the Chachmei Ashkenaz Rashi and the whole tradition did not accept many of the things that the Gaonim were doing.
So they had motivation to take them.
So they therefore had very important motivation to insist that the Gaonim did not have the authority to do what they actually did. And therefore, both the Rambam and Rashi, for example, who maintained this position, it's not that merely that they were stupid, but they were stating an ideological position which had the effect of eliminating many of the acts that the Gaonim actually undertook. So this is not simply a historical question. It's very much an ideological question. I didn't mean to get to this today, but let me just read to you something from just to give you what we're up against, because I don't want to leave you with the impression that this is just that everybody was stupid for 1,000 years and then suddenly Professor Weiss and or Dr. Efrati overturned them. There was a basic shift in many important issues between the time of the Gaonim and the time of the Rishonim. Here's one of them I'm going to read to you from a tshuva of Rav Chaim Ozeruah. We're now talking about the 12th or 13th century. I don't know the exact dates here. Okay. Here, Odot Rabbi Naphtali, She Tafas et Chotno Beidei Goyim. He had his son-in-law incarcerated by the Gentiles. V'achakach Pashru Yimo B'mem Dalet Litva. They came to some compromise with 44 pounds, I guess, of silver. In other words, he forced his son-in-law to give a get in exchange for receiving a certain compensation, and then the son-in-law gave an announcement saying that this get that he had issued was under coercion and was therefore invalid. That's the problem. Im kodem hapshara masar nodah, if the son-in-law gave this, made this pronouncement invalidating the get before they agreed to the financial terms, nir'ed ein kan beit michush, there's certainly no problem, the get is definitely valid. The achakach pisher, because they came to terms after he gave this announcement. Ika lemeimah da agav zuzi gama al magarish, that because of the financial incentive, he agreed to give the divorce. V'chein heishiv Rabbi Yishayo zecher tzadik levracha l'Rabbeinu Abba Mori al echad shenasa isha v'shaha ima shalosh shanim v'lo yachol l'bo'ole. There was a sexual impotence problem, some kind of sexual maladjustment of the husband, and he was unable to consummate a relation with his wife. In yesh l'kofo liten get. Can we force him, under that circumstance, to give a get? V'katavta elai ki tavsu at habachur v'natnu v'kablei barzel v'shamu v'beit hakelech. They put him in chains and in prison. V'achar kach olihu tafus l'fir acheret v'beit yehudi she'yer gadol v'inei hadukos. They brought him to some other Jew who had good relation with the duke. V'gazar alav li'asro im lo yitein a get. And they were going to put him to the torture if he would not give a get. V'vutoch otat tfisa natan get. And while he was in prison, he gave his get. V'notein get u'boche, he gives the get while he's crying. V'tzaveh lechto u'boche, he orders the scribe to write the get all the time he's crying. V'kushara'a she'en lo takana acheret ki'im liten get, v'kesh yitnu lo ma'at ma'ot. When he saw that he had no choice but was forced to give his get, that he asked for a little bit of money. V'notnu lo im ha'get machmat kriyato. He says, "Kasher v'tinaseba ulav." Is this get now, which was coerced, valid or not? A very, very common problem. Et asher v'lavi al diacha. I'm going to tell you what's in my heart. Lo mi bayim yesh la ta'ana. It's not only a matter that she has a good case, but ta'ana brura she'en yachol mizlakek alav, that he is incapable of sexual relations. There's obviously no claim that a wife can make that's greater than the fact that the husband is unable to perform sexually. Man cannot withhold sexual contact from his wife in her due time. The man even takes an oath not to have sex with his wife for 1 week, he's supposed to give a get and give her entire tefillah. For b'shihui onata amru chachamim ratza adashar brakav v'taplut me'asara kabin, etc. A woman prefers sexual congress to wealth. V'zot shenetagnash lo shanim. And this woman who has not been able to have sex now for 3 years, hadin ima shetetze. Certainly she should be allowed to leave. Ela afilu below kozo, even without a legitimate claim which should force the dissolution of his marriage, im hi moredet al ba'ala ve'inach ha'feitzabo, if she simply rebels against her husband and has no desire, afal pi she'eino din mikoach al halacha l'kofet ba'ala, even according to Talmudic law, one is not able to force the husband to give a get, we can look at mikol makom ge'onei ha'yeshiva shel Babel mizman zvorai shehayu achar ha'hora'a. The heads of the yeshivot in Babel, who in the time of the zvorai, after the end of the hora, tiknu shiyakofu et ha'bal li'ken get l'moredet miyad. that we force the husband to give a get on the wife's demand. V'chein katav behelchot gedolot, v'chein katav v'apai, v'lav shrira, v'chol ha-ga'onim, שיותר משלוש מאות שנה היה בימיהם שנתקנת הקנזו ואין לו זוז בימיהם. In other words, the Gaonim had enacted, for example, in marital law, the notion that a wife could compel the husband to issue an intercourse. No. There are times in which where she says ma'us alai, etc., and she can bring a case. Right, if there are places, but the situation where just the woman wants to terminate the marriage and can actually compel the husband to issue a divorce, and the courts then compel the husband to issue this divorce. In other words, in this particular level, the woman then basically achieves equal rights with the husband on the matter of divorce law, because the husband is compelled on the woman initiative, was a takana of the Gaonim, which was contrary to basic Talmudic law, and which was overturned in the period of the Rishonim. And for better or for worse, for us today, a woman's rights in the halacha are far less than they are, or than they were during the Gaonic period, where she should compel husbands to give a divorce. So for example, if the Rishonim can claim that the Gaonim have no right to enact such a universally binding enactment, because it applies only to their time and their period, and the Sofara means that they no longer have this right, then the book is closed and the Rishonim have a right to revert to the laws of Gemara, which of course is what we have in the Shulchan Aruch today. So the honest answer to your question is that this is not merely an issue of history or of ignorance, but as a matter of ideology as well. We will find other places in which the Gaonim, for example, deviated from Talmudic law in matters of contract, in matters of various other things, and therefore the debate, the issue that we're dealing with today is not a purely abstract ideological question. I mean, a historical question. Has a huge component of ideology in it.
But so Rashi and the Rambam, they were concerned that was the end of the
whole. As far as Rashi and the Rambam are concerned, the enactments of the Gaonim are not binding, and therefore, in this particular case, for example, women's rights on the issue of marriage and divorce was something that the Gaonim instituted and were valid locally under their administration, but were overturned in the period of the Rishonim.
It's fascinating. They turned it into Sofara.
That's right.
Did the Gaonim live in Persia?
Yeah,
in Bava.
In Bava. Now, what was the Bava society in terms of women's rights, the external effects?
Well, that's a good question. The Gaonim, in particular, I don't have the source in front of me now, but one of the chulas of the Gaonim, they particularly said that if we don't give women these rights, they will rebel against the community, and therefore this was not simply just something that was a result of perceived political action on the part of women that led to this particular decision. I don't want to be overemphasized on this point. The major problems that we do have today are issues of women's rights in divorce and what the facilities of the courts are. But I want to emphasize that historically, the phrase Sofara did not mean what Rashi and the Rambam said that they meant, and they certainly didn't mean what the Chazon Ish said that they meant, because remember, the Chazon Ish took the phrase Rabino Varavashi Sofara to mean that even laws d'oraita, even dinim d'oraita, were only crystallized in the Talmudic period, and that the Rabbanim of the Talmud were infallible in their scientific statements, for example, because they were the ones that actually had to give the final definition to what hilchot trefot are or what various different halacha are. In other words, in modern times, the issue of Rabin and Ravashi has acquired an even greater ideological component than it had even for the Rambam and Rashi. The Rambam attributes Sofara to mean that was the end of the universal jurisdiction of a particular rabbinical authority. But according to the Chazon Ish, Sofarah meant the end of the period in which the rabbis were empowered by God, that is, the end of the period of infallibility of and the rights of the rabbis to fix biblical law, not just Talmudic law. So,
it's the end of conservatism, of legitimate conservatism.
I don't even read the rest of
it.
How did we try and get away with it, more or less? Same with the way we don't want to accomplish. We're going to just ignore it. Well, we'll come to that. We haven't reached the period of the Rishonim. I took this out of context because I wanted to answer Mr. Weinstein's question as to that this was not a purely a matter of history, but it was there was a huge ideological component.
Right. This tshuva, this particular tshuva, are the Muslim.
That's Rav Chaim Ozarua, or one of his contemporaries. Yeah, that's his name. He lived in around the 12th or 13th century. I'll get you the precise dates because I don't really know who the author of this particular tshuva is. But, and we will study this tshuva and we'll see that, for example, there's an evolution in the Rhinish communities where they're gradually carving away at this woman's rights. Namely, there are monetary issues involved in here, for example. Does the husband have to give a make the ketubah payment? What about the monies that the wife brought into the marriage? Can she take them out? And eventually, this idea that the wife could be forced the husband to actually give a divorce, where the Jewish courts would compel the husband under various different forms of perhaps even physical threats of physical violence to issue a divorce, were pared away and gradually eliminated. And the problem that Jewish women have today with recalcitrant husbands are a consequence of this particular evolution. So the notion of the power of the courts is very important for us. But Mr. Weinstein's question is very much in place. This isn't purely a problem of somebody knowing something today that people didn't know 1,000 years ago. Although there is, as Jonathan says, there are lots of things that we know today that people didn't know 1,000 years ago. All right. I will rely on you to read the rest of these articles. I want to now move on to the Islamic period and the Gaonic period after the Islamic conquest, the time of Haigon and so on.
The Gaonic period was there.
The
real effort to pass
the
parallel between the
Look, yeah. Did they make it?